This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Fabio Rojas from Indiana University. Fabio is co-editor of Context Magazines and blogs at Org Theory. He's best known for his book, From Black Power to Black Studies, How a Radical Social Movement Became an Academic Discipline, with Johns Hopkins University Press. It's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you for joining us, Fabio.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
For those of us who don't know From Black Power to Black Studies, can you give us a brief overview of the book?
Sure. The book is about the rise of a discipline that we now call African American Studies or Africana Studies. And the main question in the book is, how did a student movement, essentially, get to become an academic discipline? How did that transformation occur? And so the book does a couple of things. First of all, it's historical. It's an actual bona fide history book. I believe that that book is among the first to chronicle the rise of Black studies from its roots in 1966 all the way up to the present. It is also a book of organizational sociology, which answers the question, how do organizations respond when protesters challenge them? And then thirdly, it's also a book on disciplinary formation. If you have all these things happening in a university, how they pull together into a thing that we call a discipline. And so From Black Power to Black Studies presents as evidence as in kind of a process. There's like the beginning of the discipline, the protest that happened, the response of the administrators of the university, then the actual construction of the discipline by assembling scholars from all kinds of other different departments into programs and discussing their ups and downs, like when are they stable and when they're not stable. And that's the book.
All right.
So one part that was especially interesting in that, and I've read the book, although I read it when it came out like 10 years ago, is you talked about the formation of a discipline. So right. Not just departments, not just how to, but the formation of a discipline.
Right.
And, a little bit of a timely thing and plays off a conversation we had last week, which unfortunately Leslie couldn't be here for, on the Sokol Squared hoax, which was not aimed at Black studies. It was mostly right. Aimed at gender studies. Mm-hmm. But they have a lot in common, and people very often refer to them as the studies fields. Mm-hmm. One reading of that, and the one that was basically intended, is that the studies fields have a bullshit problem. So... and my personal opinion is that the kinds of issues that are studied within the studies fields are completely legitimate and important issues for research. And we should absolutely, be talking about gender in novels, but we should do it in English departments. And we should talk about, race and the history of racism and the history, we should talk about the history of, racial schema and, in the caste system in Spanish colonial America and that sort of thing, but we should do it in the history department. Or, skin tone and life attainment, but we should do it in a sociology department because I think the disciplinary perspective is valuable. So, given that you've studied the history of one of these interdisciplinary fields coming in and trying to develop itself as a discipline, first of all, how much has that simply happened, right? Is it the case that people in Black studies departments have Black studies PhDs, or are they all historians and English PhDs and that sort of thing? And second of all, how successful is an intellectual enterprise do you think it's been?
Right. So, we know the answer to the first question pretty clearly. Then, of course, the second question is open to debate. But in terms of the question of in what sense are they a discipline? And by discipline, you mean a group of scholars that's institutionalized in the university system that is able to reproduce itself over time, mainly through PhD programs and journal publications. So Black studies is somewhat successful, but maybe not as successful as most people think. Just to give you a couple of numbers, when I published the book, about 120 universities in the United States had a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral program in Black studies. At that time, maybe there are only about 6 or 7 PhD programs. They do have their own journals. I've published myself in the Journal of Black Studies, Souls, and some other Black Studies journals. So we know from just this basic data that, it is somewhat institutionalized as a discipline. It is not self-reproducing at this stage. So, for example, even today, most people who teach in African-American studies programs have their PhDs from history departments or economics or psychology or whatever. So we know that. And part of the reason that that is true is that the field, when it was initially founded, was mainly institutionalized as an interdisciplinary undergraduate teaching unit. Mm-hmm. So the modal typical Black Studies program is not a PhD program. It is a small program with, say, two or three full-time tenure lines, supplemented by adjunct or part-time faculty borrowed from history or Spanish or some other area. And they intentionally did not have PhD programs.
Oh, and just to clarify, by part-time, you don't mean that this person only works at the university 20 hours a week. You mean it's like a split FTE.
Oh, yes, thank you. Yeah, that's right. So split FTE. So you know, you might be jointly appointed in, you know, history and at Black Studies, and also supplemented by a large number of adjuncts. So, for example, I am actually an adjunct professor in African-American and Africa Diaspora Studies. That's the title of our program here at Indiana. And they have not called upon me yet, but should they ever need an extra teacher for like an intro course or whatever, I'd be happy to fill in. I'm very supportive of what they do. But your question of, you know, in what sense is it a discipline? The answer is like in the middle. It's not a fully autonomous discipline like sociology, where we essentially reproduce ourselves over time. It is not in the realm of what you might call interdisciplinary studies, which literally has no PhD programs, and you know, not, there aren't like core journals where everything happens. It's kind of somewhere in the middle. Then your second question, what is the quality or how good is the scholarship there? Then what you have to do in order to answer that question is you have to say things like, what is the citation impact? That's one way to measure quality, or the reputation of the journal. And I actually published a short article in the Journal of Black Studies about this. And what you discover is that there seems to be two types of Black Studies professors, and at least in the PhD programs that award it. You have disciplinarians who publish in like American Sociological Review or American Historical Review or whatever. And essentially, most of their academic reputation comes from the disciplines, and that tends to be very high impact. And then there are people who establish their credentials mainly within the publication venues of the world of Black Studies, such as the Journal of Black Studies or the Western Journal of Black Studies. And those will have necessarily much smaller impacts. And then also, I'll be upfront as well, which is there are some schools of Africana studies or Black studies that honestly make me scratch my head. So, for example, there's something called Nile Valley Scholarship, which made some outrageous claims about the origins of Western civilization. So that exists in the same world as, say, somebody like Skip Gates, who is considered probably to be one of the leading literary critics of his time, or other leading figures. And they all are Black Studies professors in some degree, and some of them are super high quality, and some of them, let's just say, a little bit dodgy. Got to be careful with some of that stuff.
Yeah, that's more or less, it's funny that your answer so heavily emphasized, you know, essentially organizational perspectives, but of course it makes sense because you're an organizational sociologist. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what you're saying all made sense to me, and including the part towards the end, where that's also been my own impression that, you know, colleagues who have a split FTE between a disciplinary department and an interdisciplinary department, you know, obviously sociology is going to be the most salient to me. They do good work, you know. And, you know, it's great that, you know, we basically got half the FTE for free and we get to have this colleague who's doing work I like. But then when I see the stuff that seems to happen more where that's its home, you know, not kind of split with a traditional discipline, it seems to be a little less, you know, and like you said, it can get downright weird, like the Afrocentrist pseudoscience.
Well, I mean, I'm going to push back on that a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. Like, just in terms of what you mean by Afrocentrist, right?
Oh, because I meant what he was talking about with Nile Valley stuff, the idea that the Greeks got all their culture from the Egyptians.
Okay, all right.
I don't have any quibble with somebody studying, you know, Mali before colonialization or something like that. That's a totally legitimate history topic.
Yeah, well, I think one of the points that I want to make about African-American studies and Africana studies is, you know, for example, as a sociologist, right, you know, and you might be interested in, I don't know, studying health disparities or whatever. One of the mandates that you have, right, as like a scholar of Africana or African American studies is to actually like place the focus on people of the African diaspora. And that's something that you tend to not see in sort of mainstream disciplines, right? So if I'm studying health disparities, you know, I might not actually care so much about, you know, the health of white people, right? Or if it's comparative, then I would make Black people the default instead of white people, right? And that's just not something that you see very, very often in mainstream disciplinary journals, right? And I think that there is actually some, I think that there's some real value to publishing work that actually puts people from the African diaspora central to your research, right? As opposed to, you know what I mean, being some oddity, right? Or some one of these.
No,
right?
I actually don't get what you're saying, because
let me give you an example.
Yeah, please. Will.
So, like, here's so for example, when you read the history of this, one thing that you'll notice is that the push for Africana studies or Black studies was particularly strong in the humanities. And there's certainly an audience for it in the social sciences, but not as strong. And the reason is that in the social sciences, even since the beginning, race has always been accepted as a thing you can talk about. Now, early in the discipline, history of the social sciences, that was done in a way we would not find acceptable today, like eugenics or something like that. But the point is, like, race is a thing you can talk about, and it gets talked about over and over and over and over. So yeah, you'll see some sociologists who are involved in the action, but the big focus of this is actually the humanities. And there, you know, it was much easier for people to say, you know, Black people never wrote a novel that was any good, right? Or, you know, basically, you know, blues is the only kind of like Black music that was ever produced or something like that. And people would say these wild things or crazy things, either to completely banish African-Americans from the discourse entirely or to extremely minimize them. And so, you know, from their perspective, what advocates would say is something very similar to what Leslie said, which is, you know, maybe Black studies will be a thing in economics or whatever, but that could be a passing fad. 10 years from now, they may move on to other topics. But by having a program, or they call it a counter space. In the book, I call it a counter center within the academy, which is you recognize as a white mainstream, they may or may not care about your topic, but it would be valuable to have a fully dedicated space to that topic that's not going to rise and fall with the trends as much.
Fabio, what was your reaction to the Sokol Squared hoax? Did you think, and what was your reaction to the fallout, like the discipline's reactions? Do you think it's a meaningful event or sort of a stunt that's been overblown? How did you react?
Well, my first reaction, honestly, was, oh my God, I hope I didn't publish any of this stuff. I mean, you know, I really hope I didn't, because, you know, as a discipline that does sometimes focus on like everyday life events or something like that, or interesting subcultures, you do get in that zone. So like, oh my God, I hope I didn't publish any of this. So the answer is no, we did not publish it. Nor to the best of my knowledge, did we, approve a proposal or anything like that?
No, and not just you. I don't know whether by first person plural you mean context or you mean sociology as a whole, but in fact, sociology as a whole didn't give a single acceptor R&R to any of that crap.
Right. So when I was talking about me personally, because I was worried about Fabio.
I figured.
But Gabriel, so you also asked about responses from other people. So when I slowly read through it, and I was reading the write-up they had, I was like, oh my God, please let not the ASR or AJS or Social Forces or something like, or Social Quarterly be on this list. Please God, no. And then as I saw, you know, reject, I felt a little bit better. And then I think Will Wilkinson, who is a writer, kind of a libertarianish bent, he had a series of...
That would have been true 10 years
ago. Yeah, yeah. So, but anyway, but the that's kind of the
concept. Let's just call him an idiosyncratic liberal at this point.
Yes. He's a friend of mine. Let's just say a writer I love reading. I'll say that.
Sure. And I didn't say he's a jerk. I just said that his politics have changed.
Oh, yeah. Fair enough. So anyway, so the point is he had a really great series of tweets where he explains what is the ethos or the habitus of sociology that kind of inoculated it in this hoax? And I think the answer is simply that, you know, we value data for real, right? Just like, we're not going to fake it. We have our own inclinations, but we're actually not half bad at spotting fake data. And, you know, even on people who may agree with us, we try to gravitate towards well-designed studies rather than poorly designed studies. Not doesn't always work, but, you know, we're probably like the most like other social sciences in that respect. Then finally, the big picture takeaway, you know, I don't think it's that different from what you guys mentioned on an earlier podcast, which I was listening to this morning, which is, you know, we're in an era where there's a lot of public knowledge about the fact that academia contains a lot of nations. And, you know, there are some people who choose to use academia as an expression of a grievance. You know, we talked about that a little bit. And then there are other people who say, yeah, I have normative commitments. I'm upfront with that. And I am upfront with my own. But at the same time, I care about data. Like, I want to be right. And if I'm wrong on something, I'd like to know that, right? And so people who know the academy knows that there's a wide range of attitude. And maybe in the end, you know, I don't think it's going to change very much. Like, it's not going to really, you know, change the landscape of academia. But I'm just glad the sociology came out a little bit better looking than it did before. And I'm thankful that, you know, other journals run by people who I know personally made some good choices.
Well, it was I totally agree with what you're saying about, you know, Will's thread, which I also thought was interesting. But that was more or less what I had in mind at the beginning of this segment when I was talking about, does the disciplinary perspective inoculate us? Because I don't think it's just that, you know, oh, sociology didn't fall for this, but economics would. I think it's more that the disciplinary perspectives force you to care a lot about data and care a lot about of analysis and resist pure polemic, you know, both because it is the case that about two thirds of sociologists or maybe 60% of sociologists simply aren't interested in polemic, you know, and they're do tend to be systematic tendencies among the beliefs of sociologists, but it's also the case that a strong majority of sociologists believe that those should be bracketed. And that's something that you don't have in fields that their founding mission was more polemical in intent.
Yeah, the bottom line, when people ask me about the intersection of academic and public work, and we were talking about public sociology earlier, when I say something like this, I say, look, you know, you're on good grounds when you tell people that I have presented evidence to you that might appeal to you or persuade you, even if you don't already agree with me. And that, and I think that's the key point, which is if you imagine an audience of skeptics, then you'll ask yourself, what is good and bad about this data? Or what are the limits of this data? Like, what can it prove? What can it not prove? And if your discipline or area has really absorbed that lesson, and they force it down graduate students' throats all the time, you know, then I think you're in a better position than some of these other areas of academia where they run away from evidence or they view it with skepticism, you know, and it really comes down to personal viewpoint. And I think this is one reason why a lot of people, when they go to graduate school, because they have normative commitments, bristle at graduate training, not just because graduate school is kind of a very awkward and stressful process, but basically, when you go into a research method seminar, you know, and you learn about things like hypothesis testing or treatment conditions and stuff like that, you're faced with the possibility you could be dead wrong. And earlier we talked about the Black Studies book, and there was actually a section in that book that showed me that one important hypothesis I had in organization studies was wrong. It was extremely wrong. And I only got to understand it was wrong by reading page after page of historical documents and collating the data. And I realized my belief was simply incorrect. So that's what I take from the Sokol hoax. I don't think it's going to change any people's minds, the pranksters. You know, I actually almost feel sorry for the pranksters because, like, they could have gotten, like, a really good journal article out of that effort. Instead, they write 20 bits of crap, and I don't know how many departments are going to want to hire them later. You know, it's just like, I see what they did and I sympathize with it, but I'm not sure if that's the best use of their time on this planet. So there's that. But it did make me feel better that, you know, yeah, you know, if we care about real data, it could be qualitative, it could be quantitative, you know, but the point is there's standards and there's skepticism, and stuff that holds up after skepticism should be valued. And that's a good thing.
So I was very intrigued when you said you got something wrong. And like I said, I read the book, but I forgot. What was the hypothesis you had that was falsified?
Oh, yeah. So this is, comes from chapter 5 of the Black Studies book about nonprofit foundations. So there is a belief in some quarters of ethnic studies that philanthropists were trying to subvert or co-opt the area with donations. And this is also kind of a flavor of a hypothesis, which is popular in organizational studies called resource dependency theory, which basically says he who holds the cash holds the control, right? Like you have the money, you control. And so then what would the theory predict? The theory would predict that of all the flavors of Black slaves you could have had, the one that would have survived the process was the one that was favored by philanthropists. Why? Because they were giving schools 5, 10, 20 million bucks for Black studies programs. And that's not an exaggeration. Like in 1969 dollars, they're giving about 20 million bucks. What actually happens when you look at the data? When you actually read the history, you realize that people in the Black studies areas had very different ideas about scholarship and the management of programs than people at the foundations, like the Ford Foundation. There is even a point where they had a meeting at the Aspen Institute in Colorado, and Black activists actually asked the philanthropists who were there, the program officers, they asked them to leave the room where they had a private conversation about what the mission of Black slaves would be. And then after a while, the Ford Foundation and other nonprofits kind of gave up. They just said, okay, we're done giving grants. We're not able to get the version of Black slaves we want. And so, you know, maybe the hypothesis could be rescued, but at least the naive version of it, that simply if you give money to people, they'll do what you want, is extremely wrong. And it's a hypothesis that is very popular amongst people who study nonprofits and philanthropic giving, you know, that, you know, the person who gives the money is going to really control the arena of action. And that was just incredibly not true. There was a lot of conflict and revolt and dissent over, philanthropic donations. And that connects to a lot of other, you know, modern debates we're having now about, you know, people, you know, foundations giving money for this, that if you give money to a university, you control the university. It's like, no, that's not how life works. And I first learned that lesson when doing the research for my book. So that's an example of historical research show that one of my hypotheses, which is plain wrong.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because you came to that finding at about the same time Victoria Alexander published her AJS on museum financing.
Right.
And finding that the curators are basically able to play different funding sources off each other. So the funders don't have control, the curators do.
Yep.
And in this case, it would be the, you know, the Black Studies department chair or whatever, who serves the role of the curator. And I mean, I don't want to, this is your interview, but, you know, I likewise had an experience where when I was writing my radio book, I collected a ton of data on social networks among radio stations, and I wasn't doing it to prove the null. I was doing it because I thought they would matter, but it turns out they don't matter.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's my favorite finding from the book, is that networks don't matter at all for shaping diffusion.
Yeah, and I think that's the sign of any quality research, which is, you know, we could always talk about selection bias in a publication, but I think every good researcher, when they publish their book at the article, they should say, this is the one that actually survived. My other ideas all died. And I'm not showing you. And if somebody can't tell you what didn't work or what failed, there's something dodgy happening there. And you got to ask some questions like, is it really true that all your hypotheses are true? All your opinions? Is like, no, you know, lots of them are wrong. And every big project has that history where like, my God, and I can go through all my research projects and tell you about all the hypotheses that were simply not supported and were bad. My pub record would be much better, but if I could publish it, if everything were true, but that's not the way it rolls out.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.